It was the vehicle he used to create a world that was comfortable for him, peopled by characters who appreciated him and whom he had control over, as he didn't in real life. Having this one secure zone suddenly become yet another place where humiliation occurred is what triggered the break. Jordan crossed his arms, playing devil's advocate. I don't know. We're talking about an email here. Is it really fair to compare bullying to the trauma seen by war veterans in Iraq or survivors from 9/11? The thing that's important to remember about PTSD is that a traumatic event affects different people differently. For example, for some, a violent rape might trigger PTSD. For others, a brief groping might trigger it. It doesn't matter if the traumatic event is war, or a terrorist attack, or sexual assault, or bullying. What counts is where the subject is starting from, emotionally. King turned to the jury. You might have heard, for example, of battered woman syndrome. It doesn't make sense, on the outside, when a woman, even one who's been victimized for years, kills her husband when he's fast asleep. Objection, Diana said. Does anyone see a battered woman on trial? I'll allow it, Judge Wagner replied. Even when a battered woman is not immediately under physical threat, she psychologically believes she is, thanks to a chronic, escalating pattern of violence that's caused her to suffer from PTSD. It's living in this constant state of fear that something's going to happen, that it's going to keep happening, which leads her to pick up the gun at that moment, even though her husband is snoring. To her, he is still an immediate threat, King said. A child who is suffering from PTSD, like Peter, is terrified that the bully is going to kill him eventually. Even if the bully is not at that moment shoving him into a locker or punching him, it could happen at any second. And so, like the battered wife, he takes action, even when, to you and me, nothing seems to warrant the attack. Wouldn't someone notice this sort of irrational fear? Jordan asked. Probably not. A child who suffers from PTSD has made unsuccessful attempts to get help, and as the victimization continues, he stops asking for it. He withdraws socially because he's never quite sure when interaction is going to lead to another incident of bullying. He probably thinks of killing himself. He escapes into a fantasy world where he can call the shots. However, he starts retreating there so often that it gets harder and harder to separate that from reality. During the actual incidents of bullying, a child with PTSD might retreat into an altered state of consciousness, a dissociation from reality to keep him from feeling pain or humiliation while the incident occurs. That's exactly what I think happened to Peter on March 6th. Even though none of the kids who'd bullied him were present in his bedroom when that email appeared? Correct. Peter spent his entire life being beaten and taunted and threatened to the point where he believed he would be killed by those same kids if he didn't do something. The email triggered a dissociative state, and when he went to Sterling High and fired shots, he was completely unaware of what he was doing. How long can a dissociative state last? It depends. Peter could have been dissociating for several hours. Hours? Jordan repeated. Absolutely. There's no point during the shootings that illustrates to me conscious awareness of his actions. Jordan glanced at the prosecutor. We all saw a video where Peter sat down after firing shots in the cafeteria and ate a bowl of cereal. Is that meaningful to your diagnosis? Yes. In fact, I can't think of clearer proof that Peter was still dissociating at that moment. You've got a boy who is completely unaware of the fact that he's surrounded by classmates he'd either killed, wounded, or sent fleeing. He sits down and takes the time to calmly pour a bowl of Rice Krispies, unaffected by the carnage around him. What about the fact that many of the children Peter fired at were not part of what could commonly be called the popular crowd? That there were special needs children, and scholars, and even a teacher who became his victims? Again, the psychiatrist said, we're not talking about rational behavior. Peter wasn't calculating his actions. At the moment he was shooting, he had separated himself from the reality of the situation. Anyone Peter encountered during those 19 minutes was a potential threat. In your opinion, when did Peter's dissociative state end? Jordan asked. When Peter was in custody, speaking to Detective Ducharme. That's when he started reacting normally, given the horror of the situation. He began to cry and ask for his mother, which indicates both a recognition of his surroundings and an appropriate, childlike response. Jordan leaned against the rail of the jury box. There's been some evidence in this case, Doctor, that Peter wasn't the only child in the school who was bullied. So why did he react this way to it? Well, as I said, different people have different responses to stress. In Peter's case, I saw an extreme emotional vulnerability, which, in fact, was the reason he was teased. Peter didn't play by the codes of boys. He wasn't a big athlete. He wasn't tough. He was sensitive. And difference is not always respected, particularly when you're a teenager. Adolescence is about fitting in, not standing out. How does a child who is emotionally vulnerable wind up one day carrying 4 guns into a school and shooting 29 people? Part of it is the PTSD, Peter's response to chronic victimization. But a big part of it, too, is the society that created both Peter and those bullies. Peter's response is one enforced by the world he lives in. He sees violent video games selling off the shelves at stores. He listens to music that glorifies murder and rape. He watches his tormentors shove him, strike him, push him, demean him. He lives in a state, Mr. McAfee, whose license plate reads, "Live free or die." King shook his head. All Peter did one morning was turn into the person he'd been expected to be all along. Nobody knew this, but once, Josie had broken up with Matt Royston. They had been going out for nearly a year when Matt picked her up one Saturday night. An upperclassman on the football team, someone Brady knew, was having a party at his house. "You up for it?" Matt had asked, even though he'd already been driving there when he asked her. The house had been pulsing like a carnival by the time they arrived, cars parked on the curb and the sidewalk and the lawn. Through the upstairs windows, Josie could see people dancing. As they walked up the driveway, a girl was throwing up in the bushes. Matt didn't let go of her hand. They twined through wall-to-wall bodies, embroidering their path to the kitchen where the keg was set up, and then back to the dining room where the table had been tipped on its side to create a bigger dance floor. The kids they passed weren't only from Sterling High, but other towns, too. Some had the red-rimmed, loose-jawed stare that came from smoking pot. Guys and girls sniffed at each other, circling for sex. She didn't know anyone, but that wasn't important, because she was with Matt. They pressed closer, in the heat of 100 other bodies. Matt slid his leg between hers while the music beat like blood, and she lifted up her arms to fit herself against him. Everything had gone wrong when she went to use the bathroom. First, Matt had wanted to follow her. He said it wasn't safe for her to be alone. She finally convinced him it would take all of 30 seconds, but as she started off, a tall boy wearing a Green Day shirt and a hoop earring turned too quickly and spilled his beer on her. "Oh, shit," he'd said. "It's okay." Josie had a tissue in her pocket. She took it out and started to blot her blouse dry. "Let me," the boy said, and he took the napkin from her. At the same time, they both realized how ridiculous it was trying to soak up that much liquid with a tiny square of Kleenex. He started laughing, and then she did, and his hand was still lightly resting on her shoulder when Matt came up and punched him in the face.
"What are you doing?"
Josie had screamed. The boy was out cold on the floor, and other people were trying to get out of the way but stay close enough to see the fight. Matt grabbed her wrist so hard that she thought it was going to snap. He dragged her out of the house and into the car, where she sat in stony silence.
"He was just trying to help," Josie said.
Matt put the car into reverse and lurched backward.
"You want to stay? You want to be a slut?"
He'd started to drive like a lunatic, running red lights, taking corners on two wheels, doubling the speed limit. She told him to slow down 3 times, and then she just closed her eyes and hoped it would be over soon. When Matt had screeched to a stop in front of her house, she turned to him, unusually calm.
"I don't want to go out with you anymore," she had said, and she got out of the car.
His voice trailed her to the front door.
"Good. Why would I want to go out with a fucking whore anyway?"
She had managed to slip by her mother, feigning a headache. In the bathroom, she'd stared at herself in the mirror, trying to figure out who this girl was who had suddenly grown such a backbone and why she still felt like crying. She'd lain in her bed for an hour, tears leaking from the corners of her eyes, wondering why, if she'd been the one to end it, she felt so miserable. When the phone rang after 3 in the morning, Josie grabbed it and hung it up again, so that when her mother picked up, she would assume it had been a wrong number. She held her breath for a few seconds, and then lifted the receiver and punched in *69. She knew, even before she saw the familiar string of numbers, that it was Matt.
"Josie," he had said when she called back, "were you lying?"
"About what?"
"Loving me?"
She had pressed her face into the pillow.
"No,"
she whispered.
"I can't live without you,"
Matt had said, and then she heard something that sounded like a bottle of pills being shaken. Josie had frozen.
"What are you doing? What do you care?"
Her mind had started racing. She had her driver's permit, but couldn't take the car out herself, and not after dark. She lived too far away from Matt to run there.
"Don't move," she said. "Just don't do anything."
Downstairs in the garage, she'd found a bicycle she hadn't ridden since she was in middle school, and she pedaled the 4 miles to Matt's house. By the time she got there, it had been raining. Her hair and her clothes were glued to her skin. The light was still on in Matt's bedroom, which was on the first floor. Josie knocked on the window, and he opened it so that she could crawl inside. On his desk was a bottle of Tylenol, and another one, open, of Jim Beam. Josie faced him.
"Did you?"
But Matt wrapped his arms around her. He smelled of liquor.
"You told me not to. I'd do anything for you."
Then he had pulled back from her.
"Would you do anything for me?" "Anything," she vowed.
Matt had gathered her into his arms.
"Tell me you didn't mean it."
She felt a cage coming down around her. Too late, she realized that Matt had her trapped by the heart. And like any unwitting animal that was well and truly caught, Josie could escape only by leaving a piece of herself behind.
"I'm so sorry,"
Josie had said at least 1,000 times that night, "because it was all her fault." "Dr. Waugh," Diana said, "how much were you paid for your work on this case?"
"My fee is $2,000 per day."
"Would it be fair to say that one of the most important components of diagnosing the defendant was the time you spent interviewing him?"
"Absolutely."
"During the course of those 10 hours, you were relying on him to be truthful with you in his recollection of events, right?"
"Yes."
"You'd have no way of knowing if he wasn't being truthful, would you?"
"I've been doing this for some time, Ms. Levin," the psychiatrist said. "I've interviewed enough people to know when someone's trying to put one over on me." Part of what you use in determining whether or not a teen is putting one over on you is taking a look at the circumstances they're in, correct?
Sure.
And the circumstances in which you found Peter included being locked up in jail for multiple first-degree murders?
That's right.
So, basically, Diana said, Peter had a huge incentive to find a way out.
Or Ms. Levin, Dr. Waugh countered. You could also say he had nothing left to lose by telling the truth.
Diana pressed her lips together. A yes or no would have done just fine. You said that part of your diagnosis of PTSD came from the fact that the defendant was attempting to get help and couldn't. Was this based on information he gave you during your interviews?
Yes, corroborated by his parents and some of the teachers who testified for you, Ms. Levin.
You also said that part of your diagnosis of PTSD was illustrated by Peter's retreat into a fantasy world, correct?
Yes.
And you based that on the computer games that Peter told you about during your interviews?
Correct.
Isn't it true that when you sent Peter to Dr. Gertz, you told him he was going to have some brain scans done?
Yes.
Couldn't Peter have told Dr. Gertz that a smiling face looked angry if he thought it would help you out with a diagnosis?
I suppose it would be possible.
You also said, Doctor, that reading an email the morning of March 6th is what put Peter into a dissociative state, one strong enough to last through Peter's entire killing spree at Sterling High.
Objection. Sustained, the judge said.
Did you base that conclusion on anything other than what Peter Houghton told you? Peter, who was sitting in a jail cell charged with 10 murders and 19 attempted murders? King Wah shook his head.
No, but any other psychiatrist would have done the same.
Diana just raised a brow. Any psychiatrist who stood to make $2,000 a day, she said. And even before Jordan objected, she withdrew her remark. You said that Peter was suffering from suicide ideation.
Yes.
So he wanted to kill himself?
Yes. That's very common for patients with PTSD.
Detective Ducharme has testified that there were 116 bullet casings found in the high school that morning. Another 30 unspent rounds were found on Peter's person, and another 52 unspent rounds were found in the backpack he was carrying, along with 2 guns he didn't use. So, do the math for me, Doctor. How many bullets are we talking about?
198.
Diana faced him. In a span of 19 minutes, Peter had 200 chances to kill himself, instead of every other student he encountered at Sterling High. Is that right, Doctor?
Yes, but there is an extremely fine line between a suicide and a homicide. Many depressed people who have made the decision to shoot themselves choose, at the last moment, to shoot someone else instead.
Diana frowned. I thought Peter was in a dissociated state, she said. I thought he was incapable of making choices.
He was. He was pulling the trigger without any thought of consequence or knowledge of what he was doing.
Either that, or it was a tissue paper line he felt like crossing, right? Jordan stood up. Objection. She's bullying my witness. Oh, for God's sake, Jordan, Diana snapped. You can't use your defense on me.
Counselors, the judge warned.
You also testified, Doctor, that this dissociative state of Peter's ended when Detective Ducharme began to ask him questions at the police station, correct?
Yes.
Would it be fair to say that you based this assumption on the fact that at that moment, Peter started to respond in an appropriate manner, given the situation he was in?
Yes.
Then how do you explain how, hours earlier, when 3 officers pointed a gun at Peter and told him to drop his weapon, he was able to do what they asked? Dr. Waugh hesitated.
Well,
isn't that an appropriate response, when 3 policemen have their weapons drawn and pointed at you?
He put the gun down, the psychiatrist said, because even on a subliminal level, He understood that otherwise he was going to be shot.
But doctor, Diana said, I thought you told us that Peter wanted to die.
She sat back down, satisfied that Jordan could do nothing on redirect that would damage the headway she'd made.
Dr. Waugh, he said, you spent a lot of time with Peter, didn't you?
Unlike some doctors in my field, he said pointedly, I actually believe in meeting the client you're going to be talking about in court.
Why is this important?
To build a rapport, the psychiatrist said, to foster a relationship between doctor and patient.
Would you take everything a patient told you at face value?
Certainly not, especially under these circumstances.
In fact, there are many ways to corroborate a client's story, aren't there?
Of course. In Peter's case, I spoke with his parents. There were instances in the school records where bullying was mentioned, although there was no response from the administration. The police package I received supported Peter's statement about his email being sent out to several hundred members of the school community.
Did you find any corroborative points that helped you diagnose the dissociative state Peter went into on March 6th? Jordan asked.
Yes, although the police investigation stated that Peter had created a list of target victims, there were far more people shot who were not on the list, who were, in fact, students he didn't even know by name.
Why is that important?
Because it tells me that at the time he was shooting, he wasn't targeting individual students. He was merely going through the motions.
Thank you, doctor, Jordan said, and he nodded to Diana. She looked at the psychiatrist. Peter told you he had been humiliated in the cafeteria, she said. Did he mention any other specific places?
The playground, the school bus, the boys' bathroom, and the locker room.
When Peter started shooting at Sterling High, did he go into the principal's office?
Not that I'm aware of.
How about the library?
No.
The staff lounge? Dr. Waugh shook his head.
No.
The art studio?
I don't believe so.
In fact, Peter went from the cafeteria to the bathrooms to the gym to the locker room. He went methodically from one venue where he'd been bullied to the next, right?
It seems so.
You said he was going through the motions, doctor, Diana said.
But wouldn't you call that a plan?
When Peter got back to the jail that night, the detention officer who took him to his cell handed him a letter.
You missed mail call, he said,
and Peter couldn't speak, so unaccustomed was he to that concentrated a dose of kindness. He sat down with his back to the wall on the lower bunk and surveyed the envelope. He was a little nervous now about mail. He had been since Jordan reamed him for talking to that reporter. But this envelope wasn't typed, like that one had been. This letter was handwritten, with little puffy circles floating over the eyes like clouds. He ripped it open and unfolded the letter inside. It smelled like oranges.
Dear Peter, you don't know me by name, but I was number 9. That's how I left the school, with a big magic marker label on my forehead. You tried to kill me. I am not at your trial, so don't try to find me in the crowd. I couldn't stand being in that town anymore, so my parents moved a month ago. I start school in a week here in Minnesota, and already people have heard about me. They only know me as a victim from Sterling High. I don't have interests, I don't have a personality, I don't even have a history, except the one you gave me. I had a 4.0 average, but I don't care very much about grades anymore. What's the point? I used to have all these dreams, but now I don't know if I'll go to college, since I still can't sleep through the night. I can't deal with people who sneak up behind me either, or doors that slam really loud, or fireworks. I've been in therapy long enough to tell you one thing. I'm never going to set foot in Sterling again. You shot me in the back. The doctors said I was lucky. that if I'd sneezed or turned to look at you, I would be in a wheelchair now. Instead, I just have to deal with the people who stare when I forget and put on a tank top. Anyone can see the scars from the bullet and the chest tubes and the stitches. I don't care. They used to stare at the zits on my face. Now they just have another place to focus their attention. I've thought about you a lot. I think you should go to jail. It's fair, and this wasn't, and there's a kind of balance in that. I was in your French class. Did you know that? I sat in the row by the window, second from the back. You always seemed sort of mysterious, and I liked your smile. I would have liked to be your friend. Sincerely, Angela Pflug.
Peter folded the letter and slipped it inside his pillowcase. 10 minutes later, he took it out again. He read it all night long, over and over, until the sun rose, until he didn't need to see the words to recite it by heart. Lacey had dressed for her son. Although it was nearly 85 degrees outside, she was wearing a sweater she had dug out of a box in the attic, a pink angora one that Peter had liked to stroke like a kitten when he was tiny. Around her wrist was a bracelet Peter had made her in fourth grade by rolling up tiny bits of magazines into splashy colored beads. She had on a gray patterned skirt that Peter had laughed at once, saying it looked like a computer's motherboard and wasn't that sort of fitting. And her hair was braided neatly, because she remembered how the tail had brushed Peter's face the last time she'd kissed him goodnight. She'd made a promise to herself. No matter how hard this got, no matter how much she had to sob her way through the questions, she would not take her eyes off Peter. He would be, she decided, like the pictures of white beaches that birthing mothers sometimes brought in as a focal point. His face would force her to concentrate, even though her pulse was skittish and her heart was off a beat. She would show Peter that there was still someone steadfastly watching over him. As Jordan McAfee called her to the stand, the strangest thing happened. She walked in with the bailiff, but instead of marching toward the tiny wooden balcony where the witness was to sit, her body moved of its own accord in the other direction. Diana Levin knew where she was heading before Lacey did herself. She stood up to object, but then decided against it. Lacey's step was quick, her arms flat at her sides, until she was positioned in front of the defense table. She knelt down beside Peter, so that his face was the only thing she could see in her range of vision. Then she reached out with her left hand, and she touched his face. His skin was still as smooth as a child's, warm to the touch. When she cupped his cheek, his lashes fanned over her thumb. She had visited her son weekly in the jail, but there had always been a line between them. This, the feeling of him underneath her own hands, vital and real, was the kind of gift you had to take out of its box every now and then, hold aloft, marvel at, so you didn't forget that it was still in your possession. Lacey remembered the moment Peter had first been placed in her arms, still slick with vernix and blood, his raw red mouth round with a newborn's cry, his arms and legs splayed in this suddenly infinite space. Leaning forward, she did now the same thing she'd done the first time she'd met her son, closed her eyes, winged a prayer, and kissed his forehead. A bailiff touched her shoulder. "Ma'am," he began. Lacey shrugged him off and got to her feet. She walked to the witness box and unhooked the latch of the gate, let herself inside. Jordan McAfee approached her, holding a box of Kleenex. He turned his back so that the jury couldn't see him speaking. "You okay?" he whispered. Lacey nodded, faced Peter, and offered up a smile like a sacrifice. "Can you state your name for the record?" Jordan asked.
"Lacey Houghton."
"Where do you live?"
1616 Goldenrod Lane, Sterling, New Hampshire.
"Who lives with you?"
My husband, Louis, Lacey said, and my son, Peter.
Do you have any other children, Miss Houghton?
I had a son, Joseph, but he was killed by a drunk driver last year.
Can you tell us, Jordan McAfee said, when you first became aware that something had happened at Sterling High School on March 6th?
I was on call overnight at the hospital. I'm a midwife. After I had finished delivering a baby that morning, I went out to the nurse's station, and they were all gathered around the radio. There had been an explosion at the high school.
What did you do when you heard?
I told someone to cover for me, and I drove to the school. I needed to make sure that Peter was all right.
How did Peter usually get to school?
He drove, Lacey said. He has a car.
Miss Houghton, tell me about your relationship with Peter.
Lacey smiled. He's my baby. I had two sons, but Peter was the one who was always quieter, more sensitive. He always needed a little more encouragement.
Were you too close when he was growing up?
Absolutely.
How was Peter's relationship with his brother?
It was fine.
And his father?
Lacey hesitated. She could feel Louis in the room as surely as if he were beside her, and she thought about him walking in the rain through the cemetery. I think that Louis had a tighter bond with Joey, while Peter and I have more in common.
Did Peter ever tell you about the problems he had with other kids?
Yes.
Objection, the prosecutor said. Hearsay. I'm going to overrule it for now, the judge answered. But be careful where you're going, Mr. McAfee.
Jordan turned to her again. Why do you think Peter had problems with those kids? He'd get picked on because he wasn't like them. He wasn't very athletic. He didn't play cops and robbers. He was artistic and creative and thoughtful. And kids made fun of him for that.
What did you do?
I tried, Lacey admitted, to toughen him up. As she spoke, she directed her words at Peter and hoped he could read it as an apology. What does any mother do when she sees her child being teased by someone else? I told Peter I loved him, that kids like that didn't know anything. I told him that he was amazing and compassionate and kind and smart, all the things we want adults to be. I knew that all the attributes he was teased for at age 5 were going to work in his favor by the time he was 35. But I couldn't get him there overnight. You can't fast-forward your child's life, no matter how much you want to.
When did Peter start high school, Miss Houghton?
In the fall of 2004.
Was Peter still being picked on there?
Worse than ever, Lacey said. I even asked his brother to keep an eye out for him.
Jordan walked toward her. Tell me about Joey.
Everybody liked Joey. He was smart, an excellent athlete. He could relate just as easily to adults as he could to kids his own age. He cut a swath through that school.
You must have been very proud of him.
I was. But I think that because of Joey, teachers and students had a certain sort of idea in mind for a Houghton boy before Peter even arrived. And when he did get there, and people realized he wasn't like Joey, it only made things worse for him. She watched Peter's face transform as she spoke, like the change of a season. Why hadn't she taken the time before, when she had it, to tell Peter that she understood, that she knew Joey had cast such a wide shadow, it was hard to find the sunlight?
How old was Peter when Joey died?
It was at the end of his sophomore year.
That must have been devastating for the family, Jordan said.
It was.
What did you do to help Peter deal with his grief? Lacey glanced down at her lap.
I wasn't in any shape to help Peter. I had a very hard time helping myself.
What about your husband? Was he a resource for Peter then?
I think we were both just trying to make it through one day at a time. If anything, Peter was the one who was holding the family together.
Mrs. Houghton, did Peter ever say that he wanted to hurt people at school?
Lacey's throat tightened.
No.
Was there ever anything in Peter's personality that led you to believe he was capable of an act like this?
When you look into your baby's eyes,
Lacey said softly,
you see everything you hope they can be, not everything you wish they won't become.
Did you ever find any plans or notes to indicate that Peter was plotting this event?
A tear coursed down her cheek.
No.
Jordan softened his voice.
Did you look, Mrs. Houghton?
She thought back to the moment she had cleared out Joey's desk, how she'd stood over the toilet and flushed the drug she'd found hidden in his drawer.
No,
Lacey confessed.
I didn't. I thought I was helping him. After Joey died, all I wanted to do was keep Peter close. I didn't want to invade his privacy. I didn't want to fight with him. I didn't want anyone else to ever hurt him. I just wanted him to be a child forever.
She glanced up, crying harder now.
But you can't do that if you're a parent, because part of your job is letting them grow up.
There was a clatter in the gallery as a man in the back stood up, nearly upending a television camera. Lacey had never seen him before. He had thinning black hair and a mustache. His eyes were on fire.
Guess what? He spat out. My daughter Maddie is never going to grow up.
He pointed at a woman beside him, and then further forward on a bench.
Neither is her daughter, or his son. You goddamn bitch. If you'd done your job better, I could still be doing my job.
The judge began to smack his gavel.
Sir, he said. Sir, I have to ask you to...
Your son's a monster. He's a fucking monster,
the man yelled, as two bailiffs reached his seat and grabbed him by the upper arms, dragging him out of the courtroom. Once, Lacey had been present at the birth of an infant that was missing half its heart. The family had known that their child wouldn't live. They chose to carry through with the pregnancy in the hope that they could have a few brief moments on this earth with her before she was gone for good. Lacey had stood in a corner of the room as the parents held their daughter. She didn't study their faces. She just couldn't. Instead, she focused on the medical needs of that newborn. She watched it, still and frost blue, move one tiny fist in slow motion, like an astronaut navigating space. Then, one by one, her fingers unfurled and she let go. Lacey thought of those miniature fingers, of slipping away. She turned to Peter.
I'm so sorry,
she mouthed silently. Then she covered her face with her hands and sobbed. Once the judge had called for a recess and the jury had filed out, Jordan moved toward the bench. Judge, the defense asks to be heard, he said. We'd like to move for a mistrial. Even with his back to her, he could feel Diana rolling her eyes. How convenient.
Well, Mr. McAfee, the judge said, on what grounds?
The grounds that I've got absolutely nothing better to salvage my case, Jordan thought.
Your Honor, there's been an incredibly emotional outburst from the father of a victim in front of the jury. There's no way that kind of speech can be ignored, and there's no instruction you can give them that will unring that bell.
Is that all, Counselor?
No, Jordan said. Prior to this, the jury may not have known that family members of the victims were sitting in the gallery. Now they do, and they also know that every move they make is being watched by those same people. That's a tremendous amount of pressure to put on a jury in a case that's already extremely emotional and highly publicized. How are they supposed to put aside the expectations of these family members and do their jobs fairly and impartially?
Are you kidding? Diana said.
Who did the jury think was in the gallery? Vagrants? Of course it's full of people who were affected by the shootings. That's why they're here.
Judge Wagner glanced up.
Mr. McAfee, I'm not declaring a mistrial. I understand your concern, but I think I can address it with an instruction to the jurors to disregard any sort of emotional outburst from the gallery. Everyone involved in this case understands that emotions are running high and that people may not always be able to control themselves. However, I'll also issue a cautionary instruction to the gallery to restrain themselves, or I will close the courtroom to observers.
Jordan sucked in his breath.
Please do note my exception, Your Honor. Of course, Mr. McAfee, he said. See you in 15 minutes.
As the judge exited for chambers, Jordan headed back to the defense table, trying to divine some sort of magic that would save Peter. The truth was, no matter what King Wah had said, no matter how clear the explanation of PTSD, no matter if the jury completely empathized with Peter, Jordan had forgotten one salient point. They would always feel sorrier for the victims. Diana smiled at him on her way out of the courtroom.
Nice try, she said.
Selena's favorite room in the courthouse was tucked near the janitor's closet and filled with old maps. She had no idea what they were doing in a courthouse instead of a library, but she liked to hide up there sometimes when she got tired of watching Jordan strut around in front of the bench. She'd come here a few times during the trial to nurse Sam on the days they didn't have a sitter to watch him. Now she led Lacey into her haven and sat her down in front of a world map that had the southern hemisphere at its center. Australia was purple, New Zealand green. It was Selena's favorite. She liked the red dragons painted into the seas and the fierce storm clouds in the corners. She liked the calligraphed compass drawn for direction. She liked thinking that the world might look completely different from another angle. Lacey Houghton hadn't stopped crying, and Selena knew she had to, or the cross-examination was going to be a disaster. She sat down beside Lacey.
Can I get you something? Soup? Coffee?
Lacey shook her head and wiped her nose with a tissue.
I can't do anything to save him.
That's Jordan's job, Selena said, although, to be frank, she couldn't imagine a scenario for Peter that didn't involve serious jail time. She racked her brain, trying to think of what else she could say or do to calm Lacey down, just as Sam reached up and yanked on one of her braids.
Bingo.
Lacey, Selena said, do you mind holding him while I look for something in my bag? Lacey lifted her gaze.
You don't mind?
Selena shook her head and transferred the baby to her lap. Sam stared up at Lacey, diligently trying to fit his fist in his mouth.
Gah,
he said. A smile ghosted across Lacey's face.
Little man,
she whispered, and she shifted the baby so that she could hold him more firmly.
Excuse me?
Selena turned to see the door crack open and Alex Cormier's face peek inside. She immediately stood up.
Your Honor, you can't come in.
Let her, Lacey said. Selena stepped back as the judge walked into the room and sat down beside Lacey. She put a styrofoam cup on the table and reached out, smiling a little as Sam grabbed onto her pinky finger and tugged on it.
The coffee here is awful, but I brought you some anyway. Thanks.
Selena moved gingerly behind the stacks of maps until she was standing behind the two women, watching them with the same stunned curiosity she'd have shown if a lioness cozied up to an impala instead of eating it.
You did well in there, the judge said.
Lacey shook her head.
I didn't do well enough.
She won't ask you much on cross, if anything. Lacey lifted the baby to her chest and stroked his back.
I don't think I can go back in there, she said,
her voice hitching.
You can and you will, the judge said, because Peter needs you to. They hate him. They hate me.
Judge Cormier put her hand on Lacey's shoulder.
Not everyone, she said.
When we go back, I'm going to be sitting in the front row. You don't have to look at the prosecutor. You just look at me. Selena's jaw dropped. Often, with fragile witnesses or young children, they'd plant a person as a focal point to make testifying less scary. To make them feel that out of the whole crowd of people, they had at least one friend. Sam found his thumb and started to suck on it, falling asleep against Lacey's chest. Selena watched Alex reach out, stroke the dark marabou tufts of her son's hair.
Everyone thinks you make mistakes when you're young, the judge said to Lacey. But I don't think we make any fewer when we're grown up.
As Jordan walked into the holding cell where Peter was being kept, he was already doing damage control. It's not going to hurt us, he announced. The judge is going to give the jury instructions to disregard that whole outburst. Peter sat on the metal bench, his head in his hands. Peter, Jordan said, did you hear me? I know it looked bad, and I know it was upsetting, but legally, it isn't going to affect your...
I need to tell her why I did it,
Peter interrupted.
Your mother?
Jordan said. You can't. She's still sequestered.
He hesitated.
Look, as soon as I can get you to talk to her, I...
No. I mean, I have to tell everyone.
Jordan looked at his client. Peter was dry-eyed, his fists rested on the bench. When he lifted his gaze, it wasn't the terrified face of the child he'd sat beside in court on the first day of the trial. It was someone who had grown up overnight. We're getting out your side of the story, Jordan said. You just have to be patient. I know this is hard to believe, but it's going to come together. We're doing the best we can.
We're not, Peter said. You are.
He stood up, walking closer to Jordan.
You promised. You said it was our turn. But when you said that, you meant your turn, didn't you? You never intended for me to get up there and tell everyone what really happened.
Did you see what they did to your mother? Jordan argued. Do you have any idea what's going to happen to you if you get up there and sit in that witness box? In that instant, something in Peter broke. Not his anger, and not his hidden fear, but that last spider thread of hope. Jordan thought of the testimony Michael Beach had given, about how it looked when the life left a person's face. You didn't have to witness someone dying to see that.
Jordan, Peter said, if I'm going to spend the rest of my life in jail, I want them to hear my side of the story.
Jordan opened his mouth, intending to tell his client absolutely fucking not. He would not be taking the stand and ruining the tower of cards Jordan had created in the hope of an acquittal. But who was he kidding? Certainly not Peter. He took a deep breath.
All right, he said. Tell me what you're going to say.
Diana Levin didn't have any questions for Lacey Houghton, which, Jordan knew, was most likely a blessing. In addition to the fact that there wasn't anything the prosecutor could ask her that hadn't been covered better by Maddie Shaw's father, he hadn't known how much more stress Lacey could take without being rendered incomprehensible on the stand. As she was escorted from the courtroom, the judge looked up from his file.
Your next witness, Mr. McAfee?
Jordan inhaled deeply.
The defense calls Peter Houghton.
Behind him, there was a flurry of activity, rustling as reporters dug fresh pens out of their pockets and turned to a fresh page on their pads. Murmurs as the families of the victims traced Peter's steps to the witness stand.
He could see Selena off to one side, her eyes wide at this unplanned development. Peter sat down and stared only at Jordan, just as he'd told him to.
Good boy, he thought.
Are you Peter Houghton?
Yes,
Peter said, but he wasn't close enough to the microphone for it to carry. He leaned forward and repeated the word.
Yes,
he said, and this time an unholy screech from the PA system rang through the courtroom speakers. What grade are you in, Peter?
I was a junior when I got arrested.
How old are you now?
18.
Jordan walked toward the jury box. Peter, are you the person who went to Sterling High School the morning of March 6th, 2007, and shot and killed 10 people?
Yes.
And wounded 19 others?
Yes.
And caused damage to countless other people and to a great deal of property?
I know,
Peter said. You're not denying that today, are you?
No.
Can you tell the jury, Jordan asked, why you did it?
Peter looked into his eyes. They started it.
Who?
The bullies, the jocks, the ones who called me a freak my whole life.
Do you remember their names?
There are so many of them, Peter said.
Can you tell us why you felt you had to resort to violence? Jordan had told Peter that whatever he did, he could not get angry, that he had to stay calm and collected while he spoke, or his testimony would backfire on him, even more than Jordan already expected.
I tried to do what my mom wanted me to do, Peter explained. I tried to be like them, but that didn't work out.
What do you mean by that?
I tried out for soccer, but never got any time on the field. Once, I helped some kids play a practical joke on a teacher by moving his car from the parking lot into the gym. I got detention, but the other kids didn't, because they were on the basketball team and had a game on Saturday.
But Peter, Jordan said, why this? Peter wet his lips.
It wasn't supposed to end this way.
Did you plan to kill all those people? They had rehearsed this in the holding cell. All Peter had to say was what he'd said before, when Jordan had coached him.
No. No, I didn't.
Peter looked down at his hands.
When I did it in the game, he said quietly, I won.
Jordan froze. Peter had broken from the script, and now Jordan couldn't find his line. He only knew that the curtain was going to close before he finished. Scrambling, he replayed Peter's response in his mind. It wasn't all bad. It made him sound depressed, like a loner.
You can salvage this, Jordan thought to himself.
He walked up to Peter, trying desperately to communicate that he needed focus here. He needed Peter to play along with him. He needed to show the jury that this boy had chosen to stand before them in order to show remorse.
Do you understand now that there weren't any winners that day, Peter?
Jordan saw something shine in Peter's eyes, a tiny flame, one that had been rekindled. Optimism. Jordan had done his job too well. After 5 months of telling Peter that he could get him acquitted, that he had a strategy, that he knew what he was doing, Peter, goddammit, had picked this moment to finally believe him.
The game's not over yet, right?
Peter said, and he smiled hopefully at Jordan. As two of the jurors turned away, Jordan fought for composure. He walked back to the defense table, cursing under his breath. This had always been Peter's downfall, hadn't it? He had no idea what he looked like or sounded like to the ordinary observer. The person who didn't know that Peter wasn't actively trying to sound like a homicidal killer, but instead trying to share a private joke with one of his only friends.
Mr. McAfee, the judge said,
Do you have any further questions?
He had 1,000. How could you do this to me? How could you do this to yourself? How can I make this jury understand that you didn't mean that the way it sounded?
He shook his head, puzzling through his course of action, and the judge took that for an answer. Ms. Levin, he said.
Jordan's head snapped up. Wait, he wanted to say. Wait, I was still thinking.
He held his breath. If Diana asked Peter anything, even what his middle name was, then he'd have a chance to redirect, and surely then he could leave the jury with a different impression of Peter. Diana riffled through the notes she'd been taking, and then she turned them face down on the table.
The state has no questions, Your Honor, she said. Judge Wagner summoned a bailiff.
Take Mr. Houghton back to his seat. We'll adjourn court for the weekend.
As soon as the jury was dismissed, the courtroom erupted in a roar of questions. Reporters swam up the stream of onlookers toward the bar, hoping to corral Jordan for a quote. He grabbed his briefcase and hurried out the back door, the one through which the bailiffs were taking Peter.
Hold it, he called out.
He jogged closer to the men, who stood with Peter between them, his hands cuffed.
I have to talk to my client about Monday.
The bailiffs looked at each other and then at Jordan.
2 minutes, they said, but they didn't step away. If Jordan wanted to talk to Peter, this was the only circumstance in which he was going to do it.
Peter's face was flushed, beaming.
Did I do a good job?
Jordan hesitated, fishing for a string of words.
Did you say what you wanted to say?
Yeah.
Then you did a really good job, Jordan said.
He stood in the hallway and watched the bailiffs lead Peter away. Just before he turned the corner, Peter lifted his conjoined hands, a wave. Jordan nodded, his hands in his pockets. He slipped out of the jail through a rear door and walked past 3 media vans with satellite dishes perched on the top like enormous white birds. Through the back window of each van, Jordan could see the producers editing video for the evening news. His face was on every television monitor. He passed the last van and heard, through the open window, Peter's voice.
The game's not over yet.
Jordan hiked his briefcase over his shoulder and walked a little faster.
Oh, yes it is, he said.
Selina had made her husband what he referred to as the executioner's meal, the same thing she served him each night before a closing argument, roast goose, as in, your goose is cooked. With Sam already in bed, she slipped a plate in front of Jordan and then sat down across from him.
I don't even really know what to say, she admitted.
Jordan pushed the food away.
I'm not ready for this yet.
What are you talking about?
I can't end the case with that.
Baby,
Selina pointed out.
After today, you couldn't save this case with an entire squad of firefighters.
I can't just give up. I told Peter he had a chance.
He turned his anguished face up to Selina's.
I was the one who let him get up on the stand, even though I knew better. There's got to be something I can do. Something I can say so that Peter's testimony isn't the last one the jury's left with.
Selina sighed and reached for the dinner plate. She took Jordan's knife and fork and cut herself a piece, dipped it in cherry sauce.
This is some damn fine goose, Jordan, she said. You don't know what you're missing.
The witness list, Jordan said, standing up and rummaging through a stack of papers on the other end of the dining room table. There's got to be someone we haven't called who can help us.
He scanned the names.
Who's Louise Herman?
Peter's third grade teacher,
Selina said, her mouth full.
Why the hell is she on the witness list?
She called us, Selina said.
She told us that if we needed her, she'd be willing to testify that he was a good boy in third grade.
Well, that's not gonna work. I need someone recent.
He sighed.
There's nobody else here.
Flipping to the second page, he saw a single, final name typed.